Well, I'd like to ask how many of you have ever read in Charles Williams.
Anybody?
So nobody's read any Charles Williams. Well, great fun then.
Yeah. Tell me what he wrote.
He wrote 7 novels. He's written a whole bunch of stuff. You'll find out, boys.
<All right.
laughs> Then you'll find out. Maybe you have read some.
I think I've read some of these things.
Yeah. He was born in 1886 in London, and his father was a greengrocer and a stationer. And he died in 1945, sort of an untimely death. He was taken, I can't remember what it was, it's some very odd blood disease. And he went into the hospital, and 2 days later he was dead. It was that kind of thing. Most of his life he spent as an editor for Oxford, the Oxford University Press at Almond House in London. He lived almost his whole life in London, except for during the war. Oxford University Press took all their London operation in Edinburgh and some of the other places where they also published, besides Oxford, and moved them all to Oxford. And Williams was extremely unhappy. Not extremely, I mean, he was happy in Oxford because he had a lot of friends, but he really missed the city. He was born in the city, and he was definitely very oriented towards the city, and through a lot of his writings makes a lot of plugs for sort of the importance of the city. And I think that in our time, when urbanization is the thing and the worry of a lot of people, Williams gives a lot of handles on how, particularly how the Christian can deal with the city. And because he really loved that. And the image of the city, well, we have a book in the bookstore that's a collection of his essays. It's called The Image of the City and Other Essays, which is really lovely. And it's very good in terms of talking about the city and the importance of that. One of the important things about the city for Williams was that it's in the city that all things cohere. That is, that all the different kinds of, there's so many different kinds of people, different kinds of things happening. It's a much more complex kind of thing, but then all of this complexity put together under the one auspices of the city, and that's a very important concept, he says, particularly for Christian theology, that has to preach the gospel to all various conditions of people and situations, and the city provides that opportunity more readily than any place else does. And that's just something brief about the city for Williams. And he was a very unusual person. He did everything differently than everybody else did. But at the same time, he was probably one of the most personable authors, writers, editors, or anything that anybody wanted to meet. Nobody disliked Charles Williams. You know, everybody loved him. And he could talk at length on any subject. He did not have, he was not educated in the normal way. I mean, his education was all his own. He began briefly at the University of London at one point in his life, but he ran out of money, and his family ran out of money. I think he had a year and a half at London University, and that was it for his academic career. Yet most of his friends were dons or professors at Oxford and Cambridge, and he was a very well-respected editor for Oxford Publishing House. The university at Oxford granted him an honorary MA degree in the 30s sometime, and he, even before he got that degree, he was lecturing at Oxford. And so I guess Williams is sort of the ultimate bucker of the system, and that's kind of nice too. I'm going to read you several things. One is, this is a fun book. As Tom mentioned this morning at breakfast, Williams was a close friend of C.S. Lewis, and I'm sure a lot of you have read a lot of Lewis. Or know of him. He's probably, there's a group at Oxford called the Inklings, and they call themselves Inklings, one because they were sort of into things that were inklings of other things, and also because they published so much and so diversely. And so that was fun. Lewis, Dorothy L. Sayers, J.R.R. Tolkien, whose Hobbit we just celebrated here. Was that 2 days ago? Yeah, that was Wednesday. Today's Friday, right. And plus a lot of other people. And Williams in Oxford was kind of the center of this group of Inklings. He was the one around whom they sort of all revolved. And this little book, Essays Presented to Charles Williams. I didn't look. I think we still have some in the store. Yeah, we do. And it's fun. It has several. It was They were putting it together during the war as a present for Williams when he, because they knew when he was done, when the war was over, he'd be moving back to London, and he had been in Oxford for about 3 years, and they all loved the fact that he was in Oxford because they were all in Oxford, and then they could all be together. And it was a present for him when he had to return to London. Well, he left Oxford by dying, which they hadn't intended, and this book was just ready for publication when he died, and so it became then a memorial to him. And it includes essays by Lewis and Dorothy L. Sayers and by Tolkien. Owen Barfield, who was the non-Christian member of their group and sort of their devil's advocate then. Gervis Matthew, who was an, if anybody's into art history, he's one of this century's great authorities on Byzantine art. And he was a Jesuit priest and an interesting guy. And W.H. Lewis, who was an army officer and C.S. Lewis's younger brother. And I'm going to read you a little bit about what Lewis has to say about this book and about Williams, because Lewis says it very well. He knew him well. He says, in this book, the reader is offered the work of one professional author, two dons or professors, a solicitor or lawyer, a friar, and a retired army officer. If the reader feels disposed to complain of hodgepodge, which incidentally is an excellent dish, I must reply that the variety displayed by this little group is far too small to represent the width of Charles Williams' friendships, nor are we claiming to represent it. Voices from many parts of England, voices of people often very different from ourselves, would justly rebuke our presumption if we did. We know that he was as much theirs as ours, not only, nor even chiefly, because of his range and versatility, great though these were, but because in every circle that he entered, he gave the whole man. I had almost said that he was at everyone's disposal, but those words would imply a passivity on his part, and all who knew him would find the implication ludicrous. You might as well say that an Atlantic breaker on a Cornish beach is at the disposal of all whom it sweeps off their feet. If the authors of this book were to put forward any claim, it would be, and that shyly, that they were, for the last few years of his life, a fairly permanent nucleus among his literary friends, and he puts literary in italics. He read us his manuscripts, and we read him ours. We smoked, talked, argued, and drank together. I must confess that with Miss Dorothy Sayers, I have seen him drink only tea, but that was neither his fault nor hers. Of many such talks, his collection is not unrepresentative. The first three essays are all on literature, and even on one aspect of literature, the narrative art. That is natural enough. His All Hallows Eve, which is one of Williams' novels, and My Own Perelandra, which is the middle book of Lewis's science fiction trilogy, as well as Professor Tolkien's unfinished sequel to The Hobbit, which is the trilogy, which obviously was finished later, had all been read aloud, each chapter as it was written. They owe a good deal to the hard-hitting criticism of the circle. The problems of narrative as such, seldom heard of in modern critical writings, was constantly before our minds. And it goes on about that. And that's what they did with each other. You know, they read all these fun things that so many of us take delight in. Now we're all read out loud to all these people before. So when you read Tolkien, it's got all of Williams and Lewis's criticisms and Sayers. And when you read Lewis, it's got, you know, Williams and Tolkien, and they're all sort of intertwined with that stuff. And he says, something must be here be said to those who may ask, who was Charles Williams? He spent most of his life in the service of the Oxford University Press at Almond House, Warwick Square, London. He was a novelist, a poet, a dramatist, a biographer, a critic, and a theologian, a romantic theologian in the technical sense which he himself invented for those words. A romantic theologian does not mean one who is romantic about theology, but one who is theological about romance, one who considers the theological implications of those experiences which are called romantic. The belief that the most serious and ecstatic experiences either of human love or of imaginative literature have such theological implications, and that they can be healthy and fruitful only if the implications are diligently thought out and severely lived, is the root principle of all his work. His relation to the modern literary current was thus thoroughly ambivalent. He could be grouped with the counter-romantics. I won't get all that stuff. Anyway, he finishes it by saying he will not fit into a pigeonhole, which is really true. There's no place for Charles. When I start talking about the novels, there's something completely different. And Lewis also talks about how he and Williams got to be friends. Lewis had read one of Williams' novels, The Place of the Lion, on the recommendation of a friend. Williams had read Lewis's Allegory of Love, which is a discussion of medieval literature, and their letters crossed in the mail. You know, practically on the same day, Lewis sat down and wrote Williams a letter about The Place of the Lion. The same day, Williams sat down and wrote Lewis a letter about the Allegory of Love, and they were friends after that. And, what was it? He explains what he looks like. He says, in appearance, he was tall, slim, and straight as a boy, though gray-haired. His face we thought ugly. I'm not sure that the word monkey has not been murmured in this context. But the moment he... I think I've got a picture of Williams here. I don't know if you can see, but that's sort of... That's a picture of...
Can you see? Too fast.
He's a sort of a, he did sort of look like a monkey. I don't know. Somebody can look at this afterwards if you want. Wasn't his fault, no. He said something, I don't want to look into that. He said, but the moment he spoke, it became, as is also said, like the face of an angel. Not a feminine angel in the debased tradition of some religious art, but a masculine angel, a spirit burning with intelligence and charity. He was nervous, not shy, to judge by the trembling of his fingers. One of the most characteristic things about him was his walk. I have often, from the top of a bus, seen him walking below me. The face and hair being then invisible, he might have passed for a boy in the early 20s, and perhaps a boy of some period when swords were worn. There was something of recklessness, something even of panache in his gait. Panache. He did not in the least swagger, but if a clumsier man like myself had tried to imitate it, a swagger would probably have been the result. To complete the picture, you must add a little bundle under his left arm, which was quite invariable. It usually consisted of a few proofs with a copy of Time and Tide folded round them. Time and Tide was a literary journal that all these people contributed to. He always carried his head in the air when he lectured, wearing his gown. His presence was one of the stateliest I have ever seen. And anyway, Lewis goes on, and he just keeps talking, and Will, you know, one minute he says this about Williams, and the next minute he'll say something that's almost completely contradictory to what he said before. And that's just the kind of person Williams was. Yet at the same time, everybody that writes about him says he was perhaps the most consistent writer of the 20th century, but one of the most diverse. He's a very unusual person. As I said, he wrote many things. Ann Riddler, who edited this book, The Image of the City, was one of his students, more or less, as much as you could be one of his students. A real follower of his. She met him when he came to visit her parents at their summer home. He was a friend of her parents. And she talks about the great diversity of his writing and said that Williams was, he said that in order for a poet to be a poet or a writer to be a writer and stuff like that, they have to be on the edge of poverty. That great creativity comes when somebody has to earn money. And Williams, whenever he had something to say, he could do it in any form. He could write a novel, he could write a poem, he could write a play, an essay, whatever, you know, sort of, whatever would sell at the time would do it. Probably one of the great, not tragedy, but one of the disappointments of his life was that he really thought of himself mostly as a poet and enjoyed reading and writing poetry probably the most, but his poetry didn't catch on, and one reason is because it's very difficult stuff. We have this in the bookstore, which is Taliesin Through Low Grace in the Region of the Summer Stars. And I wouldn't recommend it unless you've read some other Williams before. It's pretty hard going. And in the back, there's a C.S. Lewis has sort of a guide to reading it. And it's difficult. Taliesin was not quite finished. The Region of the Summer Stars was. Both of them deal with the Arthurian legend, and which all these people were very interested in. You know, if you read Tolkien, it sort of smacks of Arthur and the Round Table stuff. You read Lewis and Narnia and stuff, that smacks of all that. They discussed the Arthur legend through and through. One of the great things about these people was that, you know, all of them were thoroughly British, you know, just right through. But they took that very seriously in terms of their imaginative work. You know, if we're British and we take this Arthur stuff seriously, it's part of the myth that's part of our history, too. But at the same time, always taking, first of all, seriously, their calling as Christians, huh? And I often think that one reason that all these people are so popular, Luther's good too, but Lewis and Sayers and Williams and these people, Tolkien didn't write that much theology, although his is present in his ring books. But I think it's really delightful when people who are really concerned about writing well, about literature, I mean, Williams was an editor, that's what he did his whole life, he's very concerned about communicating through the written word. Sayers and Lewis. Lewis taught literature. Sayers, her degree was in literature, you know. Very, very careful about these things. And when they start thinking carefully about theology and writing it, it's delightful, huh? You know, a lot of theologians can't write decently. But you get a writer doing theology, and you've got a good combination. You know, a lot of their stuff isn't very tight or systematic. It isn't the kind of theology you'd want to read to get a good sense of a system or something like that. But it's fun, and all the ideas are there. And like I said, it's fun to read, which makes it highly accessible. He wrote two larger books on, plus a lot of essays on theological themes. we have this in the bookstore. It's called The Descent of the Dove, and it's a history of the work of the Holy Spirit in the church. I've just read parts of this, but I understand it's good. It's good fun reading. So the essays, he also wrote a book on the incarnation called He Came Down from Heaven, which is currently out of print. But I hope Erdmann's is going to pick it up again, I think. I hope so. Plus other essays. And I'd like to read you just a little bit of what Williams has to say about the cross, which is really it's an amazing essay. If I can find the section I wanted to read. Where is it? Where is this? A little speech he gives. Somebody asked him to give a little speech on why he how that's called, why he believes in the cross or something like that. Yeah. What the cross means to me. That's what it was. Which he makes short work of the title that he was given very quickly at the beginning. And he talks about that one of the great offense of the cross is that God and Jesus Christ had to suffer. Huh? And people can't handle that. You know, God shouldn't have to suffer for people. You know, he should just sort of make things happen without him having to go through any pain. And he closes the essay like this. He says, "O fools and slow of heart, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and entered into his glory? Yes, he ought. He said so. The Son of Man must. But then he also did. If the glory on which he insists at such a cost seems intolerable to us, If the exposition of release from our unhappy state seems as unbearable as the state itself, so that we cannot bear the only alternative to what we already cannot bear, at least that, after all, is the situation. It is he. We may be bold to say that he knows himself as well as we know him. After the cross, we can believe that he knows himself not only as he does, but as we do. In the finishing of that knowledge, a little cloud of fresh good arises. The first sense of that cloud into which he was received when he ascended. Whole he died, whole he rose, whole he went up. Not the least gift of the gospel is that our experiences of good need not be separated from our experiences of evil, need not and must not be. In time they generally are, and even when they are not, they are apt to seem unrelated. The authority which the good in our experience seems to have over us, unlike the evil, however much less than the evil it seems to be, is united with that other authority of the God who endured his own. It is the Christian religion that makes the Christian religion possible. Existence itself is Christian. Christianity itself is Christian. The two are one because he is, in every sense, life, and life is he. It is to that, in the triune unity, that there is ascribed beyond all hope to that only omnipotence, as is most justly due, all might, majesty, dominion, and power." Now, that may have been a little confusing, but it gives you an indication of where he's coming from. Always both sides of everything. Just like I said, like Lewis describes him as almost being contradictory. One minute this, one minute this. He probably saw both the good and evil, you know, both salvation and sin. And he saw them at precisely the same moment. You know, he was probably one of the best theologians of the cross ever, you know, could really understand the paradox and the tension that the Christian life is and live that out fully. And it's really exciting stuff. You know, something a little hard to get to. Mostly I want to talk about the novels because that'll be the most fun for most of you to read. After you read the novels, if you really get into them, you're going to be tiptoeing over to the essays and all the other stuff. But there are 7 of them. They're all right here. If I can get them in order. I wrote down the order somewhere in there. Okay. It doesn't matter. We have them all in the bookstore, except for All Hallows Eve, which is currently out of print. And it was All of these are published by Erdmann's in Grand Rapids, and this had been published by somebody else, and I think Erdmann's is picking up the copy right now and are going to publish it along with the others, which would be wonderful. Never don't read All Hallows' Eve on a dark, stormy night. Read it in the middle of summer, on a very sunny day, in the middle of the day. They're very strange novels. They're hard to categorize. Some people would call them some kind of weird science fiction or something, but they're not really that, because they deal with the real world and not some kind of conceived other world, huh, that science fiction deals with. You might call them, I don't know what you call, thrillers or suspense novels, but they're not really that either, you know. I've struggled. I've been reading for about 5 years, and I have yet to come up with a deal. Nobody else could either. T.S. Eliot, he couldn't, so why should I bother? But here's something. T.S. Eliot has an introduction to All Hallows' Eve, which I'll read you part of, that describes some of the novels. He says, what he does in about 10 pages here is try to define the novels and does not succeed. He thinks that probably the closest you could come would be to the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. But, he says, the stories of Charles Williams, then, are not like those of Edgar Allan Poe, woven out of morbid psychology. I have never known a healthier-minded man than Williams. They are not like those of Chesterton, intended to teach the reader. And they are certainly not an exploitation of the supernatural for the sake of the immediate shudder. Williams is telling us about a world of experience known to him. He does not merely persuade us to believe in something. He communicates this experience that he has had. When I say that we are persuaded to believe in the supernatural world of Charles Williams, I do not mean that we necessarily give complete credence to all the apparatus of magic, white or black, that he employs. And he does. He borrows all kinds of stuff from all kinds of places as vehicles to get his message across, which makes it fun, too. There is much which he has invented or borrowed from the literature of the occult merely for the sake of telling a good story. In reading All Hallows' Eve, we can, if we like, believe that the methods of the magician Simon for controlling mysterious forces could all be used with success by anyone with suitable natural gifts and special training. We can, on the other hand, find the machinery of the story no more credible than that of any popular tale of vampires, werewolves, or demonic possession. But whether credulous or incredulous about the actual kinds of event in the story, we come to perceive that they are the vehicle for communicating a paranormal experience with which the author is familiar, for introducing us into a real world in which he is at home. And I think that's a really good description, because that's the one thing I could think of. He sort of takes everything that's real in our experience and sort of heightens it. And they are supernatural to a certain extent, because there are things that we normally don't perceive. But it's like I said, he takes seriously the forces of good and the forces of evil in the world. And what is happening then in these novels that he does is he makes those things incarnate in the straight literal sense of that term. In a person. I mean, evil in each novel is a very carefully defined person who's controlling all the actions of evil. Good's comes out a little bit differently. In every novel, there's one Christian, huh? Not always the hero or the heroine, but there's one Christian that continually makes statements through the novels, or one person then who is not affected by the power of evil in the same way that everybody else is, huh? And it's really fun in that way, and it gives you some really good perceptions, I think, of what it means that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and indeed Jesus died on the cross and saved us from sin, death, and the power of the devil. And these novels really bring that to the fore. But at the same time, they're not, you know, he doesn't lay it out for you and say, okay, this is the evil, and this is the good, and this is the Christian, and you should all be like the Christian, you know. He doesn't do that. It's not, he doesn't preach at you in the novels in that way. There are lots of places to start. There are seven novels. All Hallows Eve is one, Descend into Hell, The Greater Trumps, which is really weird, but it's fun. Shadows of Ecstasy, Many Dimensions, War in Heaven, and The Place of the Lion. And we have them all in the bookstore. Probably good ones to start with, if you're interested in starting at all, I'll tell you more about them in a minute, would be one of these two, War in Heaven or The Place of the Lion, or maybe Many Dimensions. The best of the lot is this one, Descend into Hell. This is the best one. This is the one that will be referred to the most by people talking about Williams and things like that and about what he's trying to do in the novels. They're all fun. They've just got weird things. In this one, I'll tell you a little bit about each one, and then you can get an indication of what they're about. In the place of the lion, the forces of evil have loosed all the animals on the earth. All the zoos are emptied, you know. And it all takes place in England, in this one little county and things like that, and there's sort of the center force where all the animals are brought to. And the animals become, it's almost platonic in some ways. All the animals are subsumed into one great archetypal animal of each kind, you know, like all the lions become this one huge lion, you know, and all the birds get taken up into this one huge pterodactyl kind of, you know, prehistoric creature. And one of the great scenes in the book is when all the butterflies get taken up into the archetypal butterfly. and Damaris Tighi, who's the heroine in the book, her father is a, whatever you call it, what do you call a person who collects butterflies? Yeah, right. Whatever that word is. Anyway, he's that. And the man, and her father, when he sees all the butterflies taken up into the archetypal butterflies, you know, he just goes crazy. I knew I'd live to see it, he says. And then he literally, he just lays down and dies. You know, that was just the ultimate experience of his life. And then part of the thing is making sure that he when he dies, they know he's going to do that, and that he passes into the good, that it goes to God, rather instead of being drawn by his passion for butterflies into the forces of evil. Huh? And it's an interesting book. War in Heaven, this is fun too. Like I told you, they were very interested in the Arthurian legend and therefore very interested in all the legends about the pursuit of the Holy Grail. Huh? In War in Heaven, the Holy Grail is found in a little country parish in England. An aged priest finds it in his cupboard. And he'd been there all along, but by some other things. And the battle is about the forces of evil, and then the priest in this, you know, he's just really something. He's fun. Trying to get the grail back. And there's some really amazing images. All Hallows Eve, I don't even know if I could explain this. I don't know. It's about, I'll explain it in a minute. We'll get to that one. Many Dimensions. This is the first one I read. This is a good one to start with, too. It's a lot of fun. It's about a stone that's found that has the Tetragrammaton written on it. And the Tetragrammaton is the four letters of the divine name in Hebrew, which in the Jerusalem Bible, which we now call Yahweh, and stuff like that. In Hebrew, it's the four letters referred to as the Tetragrammaton. And during the Middle Ages, the invoking of the Tetragrammaton was supposed to hold magical powers. And they were very superstitious about that. Well, the Jews were, too, but... they said if you tried to say it, it's unpronounceable in Hebrew, tried to say it, you'd die. People of Israel did. But and the stone has the Tetragrammaton written on all four sides. And if you divide the stone, you get two stones just like it. Huh? And likewise like that, it sort of perpetuates itself. And it turns out to have miraculous healing powers and does all kinds of things. And it's just, it's really a fun book. You know, and the battle is over the control of the stone. You know, the forces of evil trying to use it for power. You know, and the good forces trying to keep it in one place so that it won't get misused and they can just do something with it. That's good. Shadows of Ecstasy. I'm going to read a little bit of this for you. How are we doing? Oh, my word. I think I need a drink of coffee. But you should probably, if you're going to read them at all, you should read this one last. It's very different from all the rest. Many of them have the same kinds of... sense about them. In fact, you can put them in groups here. How we do this, these three. These three are sort of similar in terms of what Williams is saying, huh, in them. These three, All Hallows Eve, Descended to Hell, and The Greater Trumps are also similar in terms of what Williams is saying. Shadow of Ecstasy is very different. Very different. And I'm going to read you just a little section to give you an idea of how Williams writes in some of these things. This is about a man who had found the power of, he'd taken in, instead of taking all feelings and turning them outward, huh, so they get dissipated from you, you know, we share love and share all these things, you know. I mean, there's the feelings that go out from you, huh. He found out that if you take them all into yourself, you know, love, hate, all the passions, any of that, and not dissipate your energies by letting them out, you can live forever. And I think there's some truth in that, huh? You think about these things. But he does this. His name's Nigel Considine. And he has put together the forces, used some of the magical stuff in the heart of Africa, some of the things, some of the tribes and some of these, and has used it for this great force that's coming out of Africa that's going to conquer the world. And he's the high executive. They don't know that at this point. But you can know that even if you're going to read the book. And these... And he's the high executive. They don't know that at this point. But you can know that even if you're going to read the book. And these great edicts come out from the high executive. I'm going to read you one. This will give you a little taste of William's style and the way he uses images and language. His language is so rich. He says, "In the name of the things that have been and are to be, willed and fated, in the name of the gods many and one, the allied supremacies of Africa, acting by the will and speaking by the voice of the high executive, desire to communicate to the rest of the world the doctrine and purpose of the cause in which they are engaged. They announce their immediate purpose to be the freeing of the African continent from the government and occupation of the white race, their farther purpose to be the restoration to mankind of powers which have been forgotten or neglected, and their direction to ends which have hitherto been unproclaimed. They announce their profound belief that, as to the European peoples in the past, so to themselves in the future, the conscious leadership of mankind belongs. It is not an imposed but an emerging leadership, superior to its disciples as to its enemies because of the conscious potentialities which exist in it. The potentialities of that superiority do not attempt to deny the capacities of Europe in their own proper achievements. The high executive of the African Allies desires, in its first public summons to the creative powers of the world, to honor the immortal finalities of the past. It salutes the intellect, the philosophies, the science, the innumerable patterns of Europe, but it asserts that the great age of intellect is done, nor was the intellect ever that power which its disciples have been encouraged to believe." And it goes on like that, you know. Terrific imagination, you know, you just can't believe the imaginative kind of stuff. He constructs, you know, I mean, and they're all sort of possible. That's what's sort of scary about it, you know.
When was that written?
This one? Shadow of Ecstasy, about 33. They were all written between 30 and 37, except for All Hallows Eve, which is the last one, and was written in 45. It was published just before he died. And William's biggest doctrine or theology or whatever it is, like Lewis, when I read you that section from Lewis, it's called the theology of romantic love, which is, instead of, you know, not romantic theology, but theological romance. And it's also called the doctrine of substitutionary love. And here at Holden, we talk a lot about the happy exchange. You know, our boat's called the happy exchange. It's called that because of St. Paul and Luther talking about Jesus, you know, who took our sin and gave us his righteousness, and on, all those different ways that Scripture talks about that. And Williams took that very seriously, and he said that that's very possible among people, and that the way to love, his favorite Scripture verse was, "Bear one another's burdens." Huh? He took that very seriously. And he says that doesn't mean helping somebody up the stairs with a box, or something like that. It literally means taking on the burden of the other person. Like if I'm anxious about something, the problem's still mine. You know, whatever it is, it's making me anxious. You know, that belongs to me. But somebody else can carry the anxiety for me. That's what makes the problem burdensome. is the anxiety or the fear or whatever it is on top of the problem. And he says that it's our responsibility as Christians to do this for one another, you know. And it's very possible to do. I tried it last spring. Another gal and I in the village, you know, we thought, well, take this seriously, and we did. You know, she had one burden, I had another one, and we spent time together reading scripture and praying, just like for 10 minutes every day. And it worked, you know. What can I say? It does. And it was easier for her than for me, because I'm pretty stubborn and couldn't let go of mine as easily as she did. That's the other catch, is you have to be able to let go of the burden. And just at the end here, I'd like to read you just a little section from Descent into Hell, which probably his clearest statement, except for some of the essays in the novel, about the doctrine of substituted love. And this book is about two things. One is about a play being put on. The author's name is Peter Stanhope, and it's a play in verse. And then about, oh dear, what's her name? Help. Pauline, yeah. Who's the heroine. And Pauline has a doppelganger, if you know what that is. Goethe had one, and some other people have written about this. And it means you see, you have a double image of yourself. Like you'll see yourself walking towards yourself coming down the street. And it's a medieval kind of image also, which, like I said, Williams is very fond of. And a sort of a Northern European one, more than Italian. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. But the and Pauline has it, and it started when she was a very small child. But then all of a sudden it's become more frequent, you know. She's seen it like once a month for the last 3 months. In doing all these things, and it meets her, it comes around corners, and it's her double, and she's very frightened about this. And Peter Stanhope, who happens to be the Christian in this book, sits down next to her at one of the play rehearsals, and he says, she asks him if they're talking about the play, and the people directing it don't understand it at all, and Pauline understands it, and Stanhope sees that she understands it, and she asks him to read it for her one day. He had done that for the whole company once. He said, "Of course I'll read it," he said, "why not, if you'd like it, and now in exchange tell me what's bothering you." Taken aback, she stared at him and stammered on her answer, but she began. He looked at the performers. "Miss Hunt is determined to turn me into the solid geometry of the emotions," he said. "But tell me why you always look so about you and what you are looking for." "Do I?" she said hesitantly. He turned a serious gaze on her, and her own eyes turned away before it. He said, "There's nothing worth quite so much vigilance or anxiety, watchfulness, but not anxiety, not fear. You let it into yourself when you fear it so, and whatever it is, it's less than your life." "You talk as if life were good," she said. "It's either good or evil," he answered, "and you can't decide that by counting incidents on your fingers. The decision is of another kind, but don't let's be abstract. Will you tell me what it is bothers you?" she said. "It sounds too silly." "Well," he said, "if you think it sounds sillier than that," they had just listened to part of the play that was being done just abysmally. Then he goes on, he says, "God is good. If I hadn't been here, they might have done the Tempest. Consider, yea, all with..." Wait, I won't go into that. You have to read the whole thing to do that. And he says, "Oh, certainly God is good. So what about telling me?" "I have a trick," she said steadily, "of meeting an exact likeness of myself in the street." And as if she hated herself for saying it, she turned sharply on him. "There," she exclaimed, "now you know exactly. And what will you say?" Her eyes burned at him. He received their fury undisturbed, saying, "You mean exactly that?" And she nodded, "Well..." He went on mildly, "It's not known. Goethe met himself once on the road to Weimar, I think, but he didn't make it a habit." "How long has this been happening?" "All my life," she answered. "At intervals, long intervals. I know, months and years sometimes, only it's quicker now. Oh, it's insane. No one could believe it. And yet it's there." "It's your absolute likeness," he said. "It's me. It comes from a long way off, and it comes up towards me, and I'm terrified, terrified one day it'll come on and meet me. It hasn't so far. It's turned away or disappeared. But it won't always. It'll come right up to me, and then I shall go mad or die." "Why?" he asked quickly, and then she answered at once, "Because I'm afraid, dreadfully afraid." "But," he said, "that I don't quite understand. You have friends. Haven't you asked one of them to carry your fear?" "Carry my fear? How can anyone else carry my fear? Can anyone else see it and have to meet it?" You're mixing up two things, he said. Think a moment and you'll see. The meeting it, that's one thing. And we can leave it till you're rid of the other. It's the fear we're talking about. Has no one ever relieved you of that? Haven't you ever asked them to? She said, you haven't understood, of course. I was a fool. And then he would see. Will you tell me whether you've any notion of what I'm talking about, he said? And if not, will you let me do it for you? She said politely, do it for me. It can be done, you know. It's surprisingly simple. And if there's no one else you care to ask, why not use me? I'm here at your disposal, and we could so easily settle it that way. Then you needn't fear it, at least, and then again for the meeting. That might be a very different business if you weren't distressed. But how can I not be afraid? It's nonsense to talk like that. I suppose that's rude. It's no more nonsense than your own story, he said. That isn't. Very well, this isn't. We all know what fear and trouble are. Very well, when you leave here, you'll think of yourself that I've taken this particular trouble over instead of you. You'd do as much for me if I needed it, or for anyone, and I will give myself to it. I'll think of what comes to you, and imagine it, and know it, and be afraid of it. And then you see, you won't. But I don't understand, she said. It isn't your, you haven't seen it. How can you? Come, if you like that, will you tell me that I must see in order to know? That's not pride, and if it were, it wouldn't matter. Listen, when you go from here, when you're alone, when you think you'll be afraid, let me put myself in your place and be afraid instead of you. It's so easy, easy for both of us. And he goes on. Let's see. Where is he? He says farther down, haven't you heard it said that we ought to bear one another's burdens? But that means, she began and stopped. I know, Stanhope said, it means listening sympathetically and thinking unselfishly and being anxious about and so on. Well, I don't say a word against all that. No doubt it helps. But I think when Christ or St. Paul or whoever said bear, or whatever he Aramaically said instead of bear, he meant something much more like carrying a parcel instead of someone else. To bear a burden is precisely to carry it instead of. If you're still carrying yours, I'm not carrying it for you, however sympathetic I may be. And anyhow, there's no need to introduce Christ unless you wish. It's a fact of experience. If you give a weight to me, you can't be carrying it yourself. All I'm asking you to do is to notice that blazing truth. It doesn't sound very difficult. And if I could, she said, if I could do whatever it is you mean, would I push my burden onto anybody else? Not if you insist on making a universe for yourself. If you want to disobey and refuse the laws that are common to us all, if you want to live in pride and division and anger, you can. But if you will be part of the best of us and live and laugh and be ashamed with us, then you must be content to be helped. I think that's a really good sentence. You must give your burden up to someone else, and you must carry someone else's burden. I haven't made the universe, and it isn't my fault. But I'm sure that this is the law of the universe, and not to give up your parcel is as much to rebel as not to carry another's. You'll find it quite easy if you let yourself do it. And then Pauline comes up with the great question. And what of my self-respect, she said. He laughed at her with a tender mockery. Oh, if we are of that kind, he exclaimed. If you want to respect yourself, if to respect yourself you must go clean against the nature of things, if you must refuse the omnipotence in order to respect yourself, the why you should want to extremely to respect yourself is more than I can guess. Why, go on and respect. Must I apologize for suggesting anything else? Then it goes on, and she finally decides to sort of let him do it, kind of reluctantly, and he tells her to call him up if when she sees it, and to let him know how it went. And she finds that he has taken over the burden, and when she saw the image, she just stared and looked at it, you know, and wasn't afraid or anything. And that, of course, is the breaking point for her, and she has all kinds of freedom, and also allows her to bear the burden of a relative of hers that died 3 centuries ago. Yay, Charles Williams. But it's really a great novel. So this is a quick introduction. I hope some of it made some sense, some coherence. Anybody have any questions about Williams or any of the stuff? I would, you know, really recommend them. Don't, you know, I hope. They're really a lot of fun. They really are. Good. And they're not easy. Lewis, another thing Lewis recommends about him, he says you should always read them twice. You know, one, just read them for the story. Because they're great stories. They're just wonderful, wonderful characters. They're just wonderful. And then a second time slower for what Williams is saying through the story. If you try and do both at once, you'll go nuts. Easily. You know, I mean, maybe you can do that, though, but, I mean, I shouldn't speak for you. That might work very well. But they're a lot of fun. Only thing trouble with doing the session for me is I know I'll start reading another, I'll start rereading one of them tonight.
Do they talk about how they bore each other as friends in any of the introductions, or is there any personal...
Oh, any personal references to that, you mean between Williams and some of the other people? I haven't run across any. One thing about all these people is, which I think to their benefit, is they said very little about themselves. Very little. They will talk a lot about the delight they have for each other. But I would guess that this guy, they met, Lewis and all these people met every Tuesday and Thursday in Oxford, especially during the time Williams was there, and during the war. And Lewis says they met on Tuesday afternoons in Lewis's rooms at Magdalen College, and on Thursdays they met in a, how does he put it, a little pub that serves the best ale in England. And in parentheses he puts, I'd be only a fool to tell where it was. And they sort of had a room there that was theirs, and they'd meet there on Thursday afternoons. When they could, you know, they all had other obligations, but it, pretty regularly. And then read each other's manuscripts and talk. The amazing thing about Williams, he could talk about anything. The first time these people met him, these academics, you know, they just couldn't believe it. I mean, he was just any subject, you know, and he had read reams and knew everything, much more than they did, much more than a lot of the people whose lifetime career it was that subject, you know. And part of it was that Williams had this thing, coherence is another big theological term for him, all things cohere in Jesus Christ, and, you know, we look for that coherence. And he saw that in everything, like talking about the beginning, about the city. And it was because of that kind of thought about coherence that he had the kind of imagination that could draw together all these diverse things, which is something very few people have. It's a very, very rare kind of gift. And so everybody went crazy. Of course, Lewis and Tolkien and Sayers were all those kinds of people, too, to a certain extent. And Barfield, too. Yeah, right, yeah, same kinds of things. Gervis Matthews, too, really. But Williams was sort of the the all-time great along those lines. So, any other questions?
Nancy, was his spiritual journey similar to C.S. Lewis, then, would you say?
Williams?
Yes.
Who is speaking?
Up
there, okay.
Back of the stove.
Back of the stove. It was very different. Williams never rejected the faith the way Lewis did. Williams was Christian and Anglican through and through from day one, and affirmed that. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And affirmed that his whole life. And something just grew. In fact, he was a very high church Anglican. He and Lewis had many arguments about that. Because Lewis didn't go for all the ceremony and stuff. Williams thought it was extremely important. You know.
Well, why would he write so much fiction?
Why would he write so much fiction? What do you mean? I don't understand that question.
Well, if he was Christian, you wouldn't think he'd be writing fiction.
Oh, really? You wouldn't?
Oh. But he had one Christian always in his book.
Yes, it was his lesson.
Wasn't it?
Dorothy Sayers was a Christian, she wrote novels. Tolkien was a Christian, he wrote novels. Lewis was a Christian, he wrote novels. What's wrong with a Christian writing novels?
I don't know, I just, well, it seems sort of fantasy-like, I don't know.
I think that novels written by Christian or non-Christian are perhaps some of the most important theological works we have, because they describe reality for us in a way that no other literature can. Huh? By helping us step outside of our reality so we see it in a new light. And so then we learn more about the reality we live in. And you have to know that before you're going to proclaim the gospel. You just don't sort of do it off the wall, huh? In any way you think might be important. You have to know something about the reality you live in. And novels do that. And, you know, I thank God for these people that didn't separate being Christian from doing what they did best, which was being involved.
Old Testament, though, to get the real thing.
What?
What's better than the Old Testament to get the real people?
The real people?
Uh-huh.
Well, the Old Testament too, you know. But you know, we need these people too, doing, you know, the contemporary thing.
Yes, Lewis wrote beautiful children's books.
Yeah, no, Chronicle of Narnia.
Just as much as the children.
Yeah,
the
great.
What better than a Christian to
Was Williams a family man? Yes. He was married, and marriage is an extremely important thing for him. Talking about, when he talks about coherence and the theology of romantic love, and that marriage is extremely important, and they had one son.
How old was he when he died?
Well, 1886 to 1945.
51.
Yeah.
He was young.
Yeah. In fact, we just missed his birthday. It was Monday. Tuesday, 20th of September. So he did that. Any questions? Okay, thank you.